Stay tuned for To Your Health on WPVC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here are your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair.
Good morning, good morning. This is MC and Larry.
Hello, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Your Health here on WPVC 94.7.
Brought to you in part by Hamilton's.
That's right. All
right.
By Hamilton's. We'll try not to speak over each other here.
Yes.
We have an interesting interview coming up a little bit later in the show. Stephanie Murray and James Price are here from Ula Tortilla, and they're going to talk to us about that process.
Good stuff.
Yeah. But first, we'll do our news segment here.
Yeah.
What we find in the news this week. Well, actually, I found some pretty interesting stuff on nuts this week. Can't say that I was really expecting to find this, but here you go. So a handful of nuts a day may be enough to reduce the risk of death from heart disease and a lot of other illnesses. I was pretty astonished by this research. All right, so these researchers, they combined the data from 20 different studies. And here's the story. This is was amazing to me. All right, they found that the people who ate the least, they're just comparing the people who ate the least nuts with the people who ate the most nuts, okay? The people who ate the most nuts reduced their risk of heart disease by 29%. Good number.
That is a good number.
Reduced the risk of cardiovascular disease by 21%.
Mm.
Pretty impressive. Reduced the risk of cancer by 15%.
Nice.
Diabetes, 39%.
Wow.
And here come the amazing ones. They reduced the risk of respiratory disease by 52%.
Holy smokes.
And the reduction of infectious disease, 75%.
Hmm.
And what was amazing? Now, what was amazing about this thing was that it's only about an ounce of nuts a day.
Oh my!
So it's not like you have to eat a ton of them. You know, you don't have to sit there all morning and just pop the almonds and peanuts. An ounce of nuts a day. I know that it is a lot. Actually, when I sat down the other day after reading this, I started like, all right, so I got to eat about 2 dozen almonds or 15 pecan halves. And I looked at what I poured into my handful. Was about 14, 15 almonds, so it was a little more than a handful, but pretty impressive.
How about
it doesn't take a heck of a lot.
How about the can of peanuts?
Well, the peanuts are just as good.
Really?
And I am an addict when it comes to the fresh Virginia peanuts.
Oh, yeah.
I have to, like, limit myself. When I open those cans, look out.
I'm the same way.
It can be kind of
can eat a whole can.
All right, and now, this is one for the older folks who may be listening here, but Brazil nuts, peanuts, almonds, and walnuts have also been shown to help prevent constipation.
Oh yes, I know.
More
all right. We'll stay right off that subject. We'll skip right over that, but it is helpful. All right, now the thing is, one of the important things about these studies was that it showed that you don't have to just keep stuffing more and more in, that more and more is not better. Eat somewhere close to an ounce a day, and you are in great shape.
Makes sense.
Let's see. Higher nut intakes reduce triglycerides and cholesterol in the blood, and nuts are high in fiber, antioxidants, and polyunsaturated fats. One of my favorite
words. The good ones.
Yeah, polyunsaturated. I just love that word. Let's see. Nuts are high in fat. And people have always freaked out about that, feeling like they're going to be gaining weight if they eat a lot of them. And it's true that per gram, actually, this was amazing to me. Per gram, nuts have twice as much calories, or twice as many calories, excuse me, as sugar.
Hmm.
And they have more than alcohol. But again, studies show that adults who eat lots of nuts generally weigh less than people who avoid them. Children who ate peanuts usually had a lower body mass index, the famed BMI, than those who did not. And participants in these various studies, including the studies that included nuts in a weight loss regime, the people who ate the nuts generally lost more weight.
That's good.
So even though they had higher calories, They're just so helpful for you. It's amazing.
Yeah. The Edgar Cayce always said that because of the Laetrile in almonds, to eat some almonds every, a handful of almonds every day would help prevent cancer.
Well, he had there it right here. He had it right. It reduces 15%. That's a pretty impressive number
just
for eating nuts.
I know.
All right, so there was also some really good news this week about kids and nut allergies. So two recent studies pointed to the way that may prevent children from developing nut allergies. All right, and these were published in pretty prestigious publications. The first study we're going to talk about here is in the American Medical Association's Pediatrics segment, and it found that women who consumed the most nuts, who consumed the most nuts or peanuts during their pregnancies were least likely to have children with nut allergies.
Hmm.
Oh, the reduction risk was highest amongst children whose mothers ate nuts five or more times a month. So that's not a very big number. Again,
no, it's not.
That's just eating them essentially once a week.
So I'm wondering if that acts like a vaccines act.
Well, that's what it. That's an easy way to interpret that, is that it helps immunize them.
Mm-hmm.
And the other study, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, found that introducing peanuts into the diets of infants 4 to 11 months old, who were considered at high risk for developing peanut allergies, actually greatly reduced the risk of being allergic by the age of 5. So the researchers suggested that the common practice of withholding peanuts from babies may in fact account for this recent rise in peanut allergies. And it's been quite an increase lately. I mean, all of a sudden, everybody's allergic to peanuts.
Yeah.
All these kids. And, man, I am glad I'm not allergic.
Yeah,
because
me too.
So how would they
process those? Obviously, you don't.
Well, they're turning them into nut butters.
Oh,
no,
okay,
no, no.
Okay,
you obviously can't
you
feed.
Chew this.
Yeah,
all
right, you're right. Give your 4 month old a peanut to chew this, right? No, they're turning it into nut butters,
which of course
is a great way to concentrate. My wife likes to eat almond butter for breakfast, and so she gets her nut consumption in literally as she starts the day, all she needs every day. And it's great. It's great food.
Yeah, Marsha likes peanut butter like crazy.
Yeah.
You get it, the fresh ground, so works out well.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. All right, you can go to all the major health food stores in town. They are all have operations where you can grind your own nuts into the butters. So it's a pretty easy way to get high-quality foods in.
True.
Yeah. All right, here's another one. All right, this one. And the interactions of the body's immune system may be compromised by strenuous workouts, but bolstered by moderate ones.
Hmm.
I was pretty pleased to read this, since my wife and I walk about 3-4 miles a day. So to find out that we're doing the right thing, which we assumed anyway, but they're actually studying it, was pretty gratifying. So until recently, many scientists believed that exercise, especially strenuous exercise, compromised the body's ability to fight off infections.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. Because past studies have found that although workouts they had fewer infection fighting white blood cells in their bloodstreams after working out strenuously. Got to get those words out right. Because this is not a subject that I'm overly familiar with here, but this was really interesting to me. So, because it suggested without these white blood cells that their immune responses were being weakened after these strenuous workouts. All right, so a new review of these studies about exercise and immunity indicated that the interactions between exercise and immunity are far more intricate than scientists really suspected. It turns out that some workouts hinder the immune response and others kind of bolster it.
Hmm.
Encouragingly, it also seems that a few simple precautions, including consuming carbohydrates during strenuous workouts, might help keep our immune systems robust.
You're listening to Your Health with yours truly, MC Blair and Larry Stopper. We're going over some headlines right now. And it's brought to you in part by Hamilton's at First in Maine. And Larry is telling us about some headlines.
Yeah. You're listening to it on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. All right, let me go back to my story here. So here's how it works on workouts. So white blood cells typically increase in the body during exercise, much as if you, as if you had an infection that you had to fight off. Body temperatures rise, immune cells move into the bloodstream. And the stimulus for this is because the body is releasing stress hormones when you're really strenuously exercising. And when you stop exercising, the white blood cells in the bloodstream, especially the type known as natural killer cells, rapidly falls. For many years, it was thought that exercise was destroying these cells, but now they realize that they're probably just migrating to other parts of the body. So while it's true that stressful workouts stress the body and make it more vulnerable to infections, moderate exercise can protect against most of those potential illnesses. And the way to avoid these stress hormones from potentially opening up the body to infections is to ingest a very modest level of carbohydrates during the vigorous exercise. So the carbohydrates help maintain blood sugar levels and help stabilize blood sugar levels, which reduce the body's stress response. So exercise hard, eat some carbohydrates, and if you're not into exercising hard, go take yourself a good long walk. It'll do a lot.
It does. And by the way, folks, we're going to be giving away some gift pack on the next break from Farmstead Ferments. It's a really good. I was actually at the city market talking to them today, and they've got some great products. So stay tuned. We'll be giving away a gift pack from them on the next break right here at 94.7 WPVC.
All right, so back to some interesting headlines. Last week, Mike and I, along with our guest Matt Rohde, spent a good bit of time talking about sustainability, how to produce enough food for 7-plus billion people now and 9.3 billion anticipated by the end of the century.
84 years.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a long way away.
No, it doesn't.
So, I mean, this is a really interesting topic that we have talked about, Mike and I, quietly on the side as well as on the show here, because food production is the essence of survival on the planet. Yep. People have got to eat. It's one of the reasons that we see as many migrants as we do right now. Along with war, people are migrating because of resource shortages. So there are a couple of interesting experiments that I read about this week that give me some hope, and I am the resident pessimist around here, so hope is good. Sundrop Farms out in the UK, they're based in UK, they have offices in the US and Australia, and in the Australian outback now, they have established a gigantic experiment. It's almost 50,000 acres. They haven't covered the whole thing in greenhouses, but a very, very substantial amount of that are covered in greenhouses. They have taken water out of the ocean, desalinated it, and they're producing all their power with solar energy. So they are growing at this point 17,000 metric tons of organic food per year in these greenhouses.
My. In the desert.
In the desert, no soil. No fertilizers, no power. They are producing all their own power. So this has real repercussions for the future, because at this point the world is losing 50,000 arable acres per year to desertification. So we've got to come up with ways to deal with the fact that as a population grows, arable land shrinks.
Yes.
And this seems to be one of the interesting experiments that's going on right now. It takes a lot of upfront costs. You've got to build the greenhouses. You've got to desalinate water, which is very energy intensive. And you've got to put up all the solar panels.
Wow.
But the long-term implications are really positive. Do I have enough time here before the break to fit in one more quick story?
I think
all right, I'll fit in one more quick story here. And this one came out of the Daily Progress. I was really thrilled to read this. It was kind of fun because it's the first greenhouse growing operation, although it's not really greenhouse, but it's the first substantial greens growing operation north of the Arctic Circle.
Whoa.
A group called Arctic Greens has established growing operations in 40-foot containers using LED lights and, again, hydroponics. They are growing fresh greens for these remote Alaskan villages.
That's amazing.
Yeah, just really, really impressive. Now, they're still stuck using diesel generators at this point, so it's not really sustainable in that sense. They are working towards using wind power, but they still have a ways to go in that because windmills freeze.
Yes,
and it's
they do.
It's north of the Arctic Circle.
Don't get a lot of solar.
So
up there.
No, there's not a lot of solar. I mean, it's got to be wind if they're going to use an alternative power.
Yeah, yeah.
But they really have to deal with some of that freezing issue. But again, it's just really amazing to see the extent to which people will go to get high quality food.
That's great.
I was really excited to see that one.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, these are people who are stuck living. Well, they're not stuck. They've chosen. This is where their lifestyle, but that has them in places where they just don't ever get anything green to eat, and it becomes a pretty stressful process for them to come up with something that's
all right
green.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we will have James Price and Stephanie Murray here to join us talking about organic tortillas.
And giving away a gift pack from Farmstead Ferment.
All right, thanks very much. We'll be back soon. You're listening to WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Okay, now's your chance to call to win a gift pack from the Farmstead Ferments. It's a farm located out in just outside of Charlottesville, using organic methods, supplying Charlottesville and beyond with a variety of delicious fermented foods and drinks. That's farmsteadferments.com, and it's a gift pack worth over $20. If you want to call 434-284-9470 now, that's 434-284-9470. Now back to your health with Larry Stopper and MC Blair.
Thanks so much, Ben. It's great to be back here. WPVC. We are now going to have an enjoyable interview. I'm looking forward to this. These are two very good friends of mine, James Price and Stephanie Murray. And I'm going to tell a little story as a way to introduce these guys. So Stephanie and I are neighbors, and when she first started talking about manufacturing tortillas, she invited a bunch of us to come on down and taste them. And well, in my previous life, I had a business partner who was born and raised in Mexico and swam the river the way so many of them do. He's a citizen, a family, and all that. And he was a partner in my salvage lumber business. And he also had a Mexican food store. And one day I just asked him to give me some tortillas. I wanted some real Mexican tortillas, whatever the Mexicans ate. And Nacho, being the man that he was, didn't just give me a couple of packs. He must have given me a couple of hundred tortillas. I had a gigantic pile of tortillas. I didn't really know what to do with them. I don't eat quite that many, so stuffed them all in the back of the freezer. But when Stephanie and James invited us down to taste the tortillas, well, I didn't go. I just had so many tortillas, I didn't know what to do with them. Stephanie grabbed me a few days later and said, "Hey, you didn't come down and try them." And I admit I didn't. And she gave me a tortilla to try. Well, after eating that tortilla, I still have about 150 of those Mexican tortillas stuffed in the back of my freezer that I have no idea what to do with, because Stephanie and James make absolutely the best tortillas you're going to taste. So let me introduce them. This is James Price. He came from North Carolina.
Hey, how's it going?
And Stephanie Murray, a South Jersey girl, originally anyway.
Hi.
All right, so talk to us a little bit and tell us how you make a tortilla. What's the process?
Well, the way we make tortillas, which is the traditional way, we start with a whole grain corn, which is a a dent corn. It's a field corn. It's dry. It's not a sweet corn or anything like that. And our process starts the night before we start production. We cook the corn in lime, which is it's mineral lime, as in limestone, not like the citrus fruit. It's calcium hydroxide, or it's also known as pickling lime, and Cal has many names. But we cook the corn in a solution of that, and which is called the process is called nixtamalization. And then it's steeped overnight. It's So then the next morning, I show up early in the morning, and the corn is rinsed, at which point it becomes nixtamal, and then it's ground in a large stone grinder that we have, and at that point it becomes masa. From that point, we take the masa and we add it to our mixer, where we add salt. It's the only other ingredient that we add, and then we feed it into our tortilla machine, which sheets and cuts out the tortilla, and it goes through a conveyor oven, a three-step conveyor oven, and then the finished tortillas come out the other end.
It's a very impressive machine, and we'll get to James and Stephanie's story about assembling that machine, which was amazing to watch. But I want to talk first about the GMO, the non-GMO corn. So is it hard to find quantities of non-GMO corn to use in the process?
Not really. It's not too hard. There's not a whole lot of suppliers. We deal with about three different suppliers that come out of Illinois. They're all bulk commodity dealers. It's all the corn we use is certified organic. It's fairly easy to get our hands on the organic yellow corn. Organic white corn is a little harder to get our hands on. We also do blue corn too, but yeah, we have a pretty steady supply of.
And is blue corn? Honestly, I've never seen it on the cob. Is blue corn blue on the cob? And do you get that in the same way?
Yeah, it's there are blue kernels.
Okay,
and the blue corn that we get is it's a hybrid that it was selected to actually. To be not just blue on the skin. A lot of heirloom corns, their color is just all on the skin. And so they selected, and, you know, through using these heirloom corns and stuff, they selected how to get that color in the actual endosperm. So the masa actually does come out
blue. So we are listening to James and Stephanie from Ula Tortilla talking about their story and about how they make these wonderful tortillas right here on 94.7 WPVC. Brought to you in part by Hamilton's at First and Main.
And I'm Larry Stopper, and that was MC Blair talking to you. And then now back to James here, I want to understand, there's no local options for getting that corn. You gotta reach out all the way to Illinois to get bulk non-GMO corn.
Well, actually, when we started, we were using all local corn. We got to a certain point, though, where the corn we were getting, it had to be sifted, and it took a whole lot of cleaning the corn, basically, to get it to food grade. The things we were sifting out was mostly small pieces of cracked corn and the occasional, like, chunk of corn cob and whatnot. It was just really labor-intensive, and it took me many hours to clean, a few hundred pounds of corn, so we had to switch eventually to dealing with a bulk commodity dealers.
Okay. All right, so I want to bring Stephanie in here for just a second. She's a little reluctant to come to that microphone, but I'm going to bring Stephanie in here because I want her to talk to us a little bit about the inspiration for making tortillas. I mean, where'd it come from? You're a South Jersey girl.
I am. But we ate a lot of tortillas at our house, and I was making them from store-bought masa harina, and I started to, you know, look into finding organic non-GMO masa harina, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So that's how we started the process. We grew our own corn, and we started experimenting with nixtamalization and grinding and pressing our own tortillas, and that's kind of where, you know, you came in, Larry. We started sharing them with our friends, and it all kind of snowballed from there.
Was it a lot of experimentation to figure out the mix? What was the right, or is it just sort of just corn and water and tortillas and just I mean lime, you know, how do you know, it's a mystery to me. To all I'm getting is these beautiful round tortillas in this plastic package. I'm kind of wondered the whole story.
I mean, finding the measurements for the lime and water, it is really kind of like a science and a lot of experimenting, and James actually was the one that came up with the final recipe. So,
well, we'll give him credit, but yeah. I want to give you a little credit here. All right, so you guys are also making chips.
Yes.
All right, talk to us a little bit about how you make a chip.
Well, basically, we just, instead of having the cutter for the tortillas, we have a chip cutter that cuts the masa into triangles and then bakes it, and then we fry it in coconut oil.
Okay, so you bake it at the same temperature and stuff, and then you fry it again in a coconut
exactly.
oil.
Exactly. The process up until the cutting is the same as the tortillas.
Okay. Okay. All right, so talk to us a little bit about the equipment, because this was a very entertaining story. I went over to visit James and Stephanie while they were installing the first serious tortilla maker, and James was sitting there puzzled, and I have a great deal of faith in James that he can assemble most anything, but it's a good story here, so share it with folks, James.
The beginning of our equipment first was a hand grinder and a press, and That's how we started.
Right.
And then we progressed to this.
Then we bought the tortilla making machine came in.
Our machine, the main part of our operation, we bought straight from Mexico, and it came in many pieces, and it's a pretty large machine. And I had to fiddle with it for a while to get it to figure out exactly. But now I know it like the back of my hand, and we've since moved our operation to Waynesboro. And it was a lot easier the second time around.
Okay, but you're not telling people that this large machine came with no instructions whatsoever.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And in order to get questions answered, they had to call Mexico.
Yeah, that's true. And we don't actually speak Spanish, we had to. We've been through a few different machine changes, a handful of different. Like we started, like Stephanie said, with a hand press, and then we got a one of these heated hand presses that like also people make pizza dough and stuff out of. It didn't really work. And then we found on eBay, I believe it was, a small machine that cut the corn, the corn tortillas out, but didn't cook them, so we had to cook them on a griddle. We did that for about a year before we finally upgraded to our big machine that we have now. And we're actually now we're looking towards actually replacing it with an even bigger one.
Oh, cool. Good for you guys.
Yeah.
All right, so you're listening to Your Health on WPVC. This is Larry Stopper along
MC
with
Blair.
MC Blair right there. We are interviewing Stephanie Murray and James Price, the owners and makers of Ula Tortilla.
Good stuff.
Yeah. All right, so where can we get them in town? What places can we get them in town? And how'd you develop that distribution network? It's not easy to just start walking into stores with tortillas in your hands and saying, "Here, buy mine." So talk to us a little bit about figuring that one out.
Well, our very first store was Rebecca's, and that was easy because I'm friends with Bill, so he hooked us up and got us in there. And I guess mostly we did farmers market in the beginning. And then the Daily Progress did an article on us.
Oh, I didn't even see that. That's great.
And then the local food forager from Whole Foods saw that article and contacted us. And that got us into Whole Foods. And it just grew from there. I mean, we do a lot of going into stores and saying, "Hey, here's our product." You know, as far as the chips go, we're only in a handful of stores. We haven't reached out to any stores. Any stores that we're in reached out to us. Because our production isn't up to that kind of
commercial
level
speed
yet.
At this point on chip making.
Right. So for our chips, which have proven to be very popular.
Yeah, they're great. They are great. Oh, especially the lime ones. Ooh, yeah. Those are great.
They are. And so you can get those at Feast, Greenwood, Shark 2 at UVA, and Rebecca's.
All right.
That's about it for the chips. But you know, the tortillas are in a lot of places, and you can find them at ulatortilla.com.
Great. All right. We got more questions. Don't just run away from that microphone, Stephanie. I got more questions for you. Because I know that you guys, because I know you well enough, I know you didn't use bank loans and prepare the business plan and go and knock on all these various money raising options. So how'd you put together the first capital to go for it? Because, and I'm asking this question because I know that I'm hoping there are people out there listening who have their own products that they're interested in making, but don't know the steps, aren't sure of exactly how to take it from inside their head to a store shelf. And, you know, it's a whole process, I mean, about packaging and knocking on doors. And Stephanie, as personable as she is not the most aggressive salesperson that I've ever met. And so it takes some guts. It takes some real confidence in your product to be able to walk in cold to a store and say, here, you're going to like these. So tell us a little bit about how you raised the funds to put it together.
Well, we never intended for this to be what it is today. We were just going to market with our tortillas, and we didn't need much capital for that. We're a business plan. And, you know, as we grew, we started asking friends and family to help us out. And by that time, you know, people knew that we had something that was going to, you know, move on the shelves. So people were generous with helping us out in that way. But I mean, really, it just all went slow, and we raised the money as we went and paid off the loans as we went. And
family and friends, mostly?
Family and friends, yep.
Yeah, yeah. So it's possible to do it that way.
Yeah.
And the packaging, did you use professional assistance in putting together the packaging and the logos and all that, or did you just kind of work on it yourself, work on it with friends, and are able to do it that way?
Well, James started with our original logo, just drawing it at home one night with the kids with their, like, colored pencils. And, and you know, we wanted to refine it, we reached out to our friend Mir Danye from Sylvan Graphics, and she's awesome. She designed our new packaging, and she cleaned up our logo. And, yeah, that's...
So, I mean, because the point of why I'm asking the question is that I really do want to encourage people out there who are thinking about entrepreneuring with food, that it's possible, that the farmers markets are a great way to introduce a product. You can put it in front of people without big capital outlays and see if you get the kind of response that can push you further in the production range, push you further to make these things. It's very possible to do these things.
Yeah, we also did an Indiegogo campaign pretty early on, too, that was really helpful. And we bought our first stone grinder with those funds from that Indiegogo campaign. And, yeah, which we've actually outgrown that grinder since then. But, yeah, that was a good push for us back then, because we really couldn't have come up with the funds on our own.
Yeah, so some of those self-funding starts, the GoFundMe sites, really do work, really enable people to take those steps and put something out there. Once you put something out there, once you have stores interested, once you have a product, then you can actually find greater funding from more traditional sources. But initially,
exactly,
traditional sources are not just going to fund people.
Yeah, you kind of have to prove yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
initially,
it's totally possible. I mean, it's been a learning process. We've learned a lot along the way. We were just basically homesteading and raising our kids, and here we've learned so much.
No business background.
Nope.
Not
at all.
Yeah, that's really great. Go ahead, James.
Actually, not having a business background was probably positive for us, because if we were business people and thinking, what can we do to start a business, this wouldn't have been it. There's a lot of tricky things about our business that if we were just business people looking for an easy way to make money, we wouldn't have done this.
Well, I think that food product can be a very challenging thing. You're dealing with perishable items. So I know that you guys have a refrigerated truck, and when you make deliveries, two refrigerated trucks now. Yeah, it is, you know, and you've done all this slowly and surely, based on the capital that's come in. You've reinvested the capital, and it's a pretty impressive operation. So any other products in the pipeline? You thinking about making anything else these days?
Well, we think about adding a handful of other like flavors to our line. We want to make a white corn tortilla, which we have in the past just for the farmers markets. We don't currently have any packaging for it, like to put it out there on the shelf. So there's that, and doing more chip flavors, doing some potentially flavored tortillas. Now that we have a high quality mixer in our new shop, that we can actually add things to our masa, like to make like a. You know, like adding like Chipotle or something to masa to make flavored tortillas is something that we really want to experiment with.
I'm going to look forward to these things. Did we get any callers, by the way, for our giveaway? Well, I'm not hearing any response on that. By the way, you are listening to WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. I'm Larry Stopper here with MC Blair. And
hello.
We are at the very end here of our interview with Stephanie Murray and James Price, Ula Tortilla. So head on out to those farmers markets. Is the Sevo market still going on? Are you guys there at the Sevo market?
The holiday market's going on now, but we are not. It's too cold for us.
All right, I hear that. All right, well, we're going to go to a break right now. We're going to go to a break. Thank you so much, James and Stephanie, for
coming on into the studio
and joining us here. And we'll be back in just a couple moments with more of To Your Health.
Hey, we're back to your health here at 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. And we'd like to give a shout-out to Kate from Charlottesville, who won the Farmstead Ferment gift pack. Pretty good. Farmstead Ferments, their products support the immune system and contain antioxidants. Pretty good stuff to have in your system, those antioxidants.
Yeah.
And the website is farmsteadferments.com.
There it is, right there on that sheet.
Congratulations, Kate.
Hope
you enjoy those. This section, I'd like to talk a little bit about food as medicine. And, you know, it's funny. I was in a doctor's office a while back, and my doctor said that, there's been some talk. We think diet has something to do with health.
No.
Unbelievable.
No, they said that?
I swear they said that, man.
I can't believe that.
I know, right? Who knew? Yeah, right. I mean, I think I first heard you are what you eat probably 40-plus years ago, and it's true. It's amazing.
However, you can change that.
You can.
Otherwise, I'd still be a burger.
Right. Exactly. Well, I have a story of a gal who is an MD currently in Iowa doing studies on diet with diseases, mainly the autoimmune diseases, the MS, mm-hmm. Parkinson's, Huntington's, Alzheimer's.
My mother had lupus, so I am familiar with autoimmune
Totally
diseases.
Familiar with that. And this gal had late stage secondary progressive MS, which mm-hmm. unfortunately it's not the kind that goes into remission. It's the kind that eventually you'll be relegated to a wheelchair for the rest of your life, however long that is, and eventually you'll give out. Just
very
like
debilitating.
Exactly. And normally that particular type of MS is very, very poor responses to treatment. She went through chemo and all the immune depressants or suppressants so that they could get in there and work on the disease. She got the best evidence-based care possible. Using a wheelchair, told that the functions lost, once those functions are lost, they don't come back.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's a lot of hope. Well, anyway, so she studied MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Huntington's, and she identified antibody complexes that destroy the myelin coating, which is the protective covering that surrounds our nerves. And just like a electric wire, you know, which our nerves, it's chemical responses as opposed to electrical, but they're chemically based. And if you took all the insulation off a wire bundle and those wires were touching, you wouldn't get a lot of response other than a short circuit and some sort of problem.
Failure,
exactly, completely. And the same thing, the nerves, when that myelin coating erodes, then that's what happens. And that's what those diseases are. There's several pathways that can lead to those diseases. Obviously, DNA, your inheritance. Some people inherit the traits that are predisposed them to get those diseases. There are also infections, toxic exposures, from the environment, hormonal imbalances, your allergies or sensitizations to food, your stress level. And, of course, you don't have any control over your DNA. You can't go in there and mess with that. But you can alter or control those other six factors.
Using diet.
Altering the diet leads to a stronger immune system. And these factors play a direct role in the development of nearly all chronic diseases, from depression, learning disability, autism, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. I mean, it's amazing, you know. So the medicines that they give you do suppress the symptoms for a short time. They don't take them away. It takes eating the foods that your mitochondria needs. Now, the mitochondria is in each cell, and it's basically the energy center, if you will, or the distribution center. And it distributes the nutrients to all the different parts of the cell so that cell stays healthy until it's time to die. Then it gives the die signal, and the cell dies. Well, if the die signal isn't given because the mitochondria is not healthy, you get cells that think they're immortal, and then they rapidly proliferate, and so then you get what they call cancer, and that's basically what it is. I actually checked with an expert. He said, "Yeah, that's what it is."
That is what it is.
You're listening to Your Health on 94.7 with me, MC Blair, and Larry Stopper, and we're talking about food as medicine. So only you can provide your body with the building blocks for the cells so that they can do the work of restoring health and vitality. And let me tell you, folks, they do. When your cells are healthy, and we know our bodies do heal themselves when you give them the right fuel or food, just like a good, a machine. If you feed a machine watered down diesel or gas or whatever it is it has to use to run, it's not going to run very well, and then it will fail, just like your body fails. So the mitochondrial health is essential to your cell health, and if your cells are healthy, you're healthy.
Yeah.
And I want to mention a little bit about what happened to me once I started. Years ago, I was told by Gail Hobbs Page that I should eat this certain way, which is sustainably grown and, pastured pork and poultry and grass-fed beef. And after changing to that diet about 12 years ago, I haven't had as much as a sniffle for 12 years.
Oh, and that's pretty impressive.
I used to get a couple of colds a year,
yeah,
just
sure.
like everybody,
yeah.
And feel bad and go through it and get over it. I owe to my parents a healthy platform, but, other than that, I was eating, fast foods 3-4 times a week and, didn't pay attention by get your nabs at the 7-Eleven, or whatever, and I didn't even pay attention to ingredients lists. So I consider myself lucky that I didn't get something at that point.
Yeah.
And now I'm just, feeling great. Well, mitochondria failure drives the development of diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, hypertension, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Parkinson's. Where's the G? There's supposed to be a G there. I swear. And many psychiatric disorders.
Uh-huh.
So it's really, really important to keep those mitochondria healthy. There's one other factor, one other thing that you can do, especially if you have one of these diseases. Obviously, you change your diet. It's a plant-based diet with some grass-fed beef, pastured pork and poultry mixed in, probably 3 to 4 ounces of that per day. You know, you don't go in there and eat a 20-ounce steak. You know,
I saw one of those advertised on a restaurant menu the other day, and I just was astonished at even the thought of that size piece of beef landing on a plate in front of me.
Well, I know.
The thought was intimidating.
It is. And I used to do that. You know, when I was a kid, I was an athlete, and I would eat like crazy.
Yeah.
Do
you ever fool with that paleo diet? Or do you follow that at all?
I do, in the sense that the hunter-gatherers, which is paleo diet, they didn't have a lot of meat because it was hard to get, you know? You sneak up to a deer or a buffalo or whatever and hit it with a rock.
They aren't easy to sneak up on.
I know. And then, of course, they would get, small rodents and that sort of thing. But their meat was not... First off, it was raw because they weren't cooking a lot of stuff, and then they had what was in season. That's why they were hunter gatherers. They would travel and pick nuts off the trees or whatever
fruits,
was growing.
Berries.
Exactly, and so without having to sit around and grind wheat for flour and all that, so that came when we committed agriculture about 10,000 years ago. But the other thing, along with the proper diet, is electrical stimulation. And of course, I'm not talking about putting your finger in a light socket. They actually make machines that give you these mild electric stimulants that stimulate the muscles. And the athletes have used that for years and years and years. But it also improves bladder control in MS patients. It decreases spasm in patients with cerebral palsy.
Uh-huh.
It improves the ability of patients with severe heart disease to do their daily tasks.
Uh-huh.
So that goes along with the diet.
All right, I just want to remind you here, you are listening to Your Health here on WPVC. I'm Larry Stopper, and we are listening to MC Blair talk to us about food as medicine on the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville.
And it's also brought to you in part by Hamilton's First in Maine.
Yes.
All right. Also by Farmstead Ferments. Also, the electrical stimulation, along, of course, with the intense plant-based diet. I just wanted to say also that when I say plant-based, I'm talking about 3 cups of green leafy vegetables, your kale, spinach, chards, 3 cups of cruciferous, your broccoli, your sweet potatoes, your red cabbage, and 3 cups of colored fruits and vegetables. Basically that's the diet, and 4 ounces of grass-fed beef or pastured pork or poultry every day. So that's it. It's definitely plant-based. 9 cups of plants and 4 ounces of meat. And as it says, the simple things you can do to heal from a chronic disease is diet, which we've been talking about, electrical stimulation. And then for the stress levels, you've got yoga or meditation, which I think you do some of that, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a regular yoga guy.
I thought so. And does that release the stress?
Oh, it's wonderful. I get up in the morning first thing, and before I turn the radio on and listen to all that incredibly bad news, especially lately, I try to do a little bit of yoga. I mean, it's wonderful for waking up the body as well. It really,
right.
it wakes up my appetite. Gives me a chance to sort of get settled in the morning and get my body a little stretched out and ready to face whatever it is I'm planning on doing. Some days it isn't a whole heck of a lot, but especially when I'm going out there to cut some firewood for my house, doing those yoga stretches in the morning makes a big difference in how I feel when I come back in at the end of the day.
And reducing stress, you have a happier life.
Yeah.
And I know you guys eat pretty darn healthily. You know, you get a lot of your stuff from the farmer's market, and I know you do organic and since you've been doing the show, you probably pay a little more attention to the sustainably raised.
We've been. I'll throw a shout out to Whispering Hill Farm, operating over in Nelson County. I've been able to score fresh greens from them right on up. I think they're going to go into January, and they're not even growing them in a greenhouse. I was astonished to find that out this morning.
Oh, my.
Did my pickup this morning, and they're not even growing them in a greenhouse. They're just growing them in simple hoop houses right now.
Wow.
But, of course, as it hits the upper teens, which it did last night, that's fading out. So they're gonna quit their production somewhere in the next couple of weeks or so. But yeah, food is medicine. That is the bottom line.
It absolutely is, and there's no doubt. I myself and countless other people that I've talked to say the same thing.
Well, it brings it right back around to the first thing that we talked about today: eating nuts.
Exactly.
Because while it's full of dietary fiber and this and that and the other thing, proteins, it's helping prevent diseases.
Exactly.
Your body wants these particular nutrients as ways as providing specific ingredients to fight off disease.
Exactly.
That's the way we did it before we had medicine. Before there were anabolic steroids, and which, when we were talking autoimmune disease, my mother, who survived her lupus for 50 years, but she spent, I don't know, 15 years just puffed up like I'm thinking of the tire.
The Michelin tire guy.
There you go. Yeah. Because the anabolic steroids were just screwing with her insides, but they never had any they never had any suggestions on diet from my mother back then.
Yeah.
It was all drugs.
Oh, yeah. And now you are listening to Your Health on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, WPVC. I want to say, next week, folks, we have a real treat. We have John Whiteside from Wolf Creek Farm in Madison County. I'm a loyal customer, and he is a producer of the finest grass-fed beef in the area, in my opinion. He's an animal welfare produced. He's a certified grass farm. Both of those certifications you can't pay for. You actually have to do the work.
Got to earn them.
You got to earn them, and they're tough to get, but he's got them. And it'll be a really good discussion with John Whiteside of Wolf Creek Farm.
All right. Well, I'm going to look forward to hearing John next week. Stay tuned for Club Sabor.
Yeah.
Terrific Latin music as we all head on home. Appreciate everybody listening to us. I'm Larry Stopper.
I'm C. Blair here.
And we appreciate listening to Your Health here on WPVC.
You've been listening to Your Health with your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.